This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. You're listening to what we expect from a solo trumpeter, a great virtuoso. My guest is playing the final movement of the well-known Trumpet Concerto by Franz Joseph Haydn, here accompanied by the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. This week, we will chat with that artist who, even though she has yet to turn 30, has been performing since she was 18, with most of those years being in the brightest spotlight classical artists can garner. And more to the point, she has been redefining many norms about her instrument and about our preconceived ideas for what a solo trumpet virtuoso should be. We'll speak today with Norwegian trumpet player Tina Ting Helseth. Raised in a music-loving, though eclectic household where her mother played trumpet on an amateur basis, Tina, as you'll hear, always knew playing the trumpet and being one of the few global trumpet soloists to achieve fame would be her destiny. She, along with past Cadenza guest British trumpeter Alison Balsam, exude beauty, fun, and glowing, engaging personalities quite unlike what has been seen before or associated at times with their instrument. My guest, though highly accomplished in her homeland, burst onto the scene like a comet with high-profile performances at the BBC Proms, playing at the Nobel Peace Prize concert, and being labeled a superstar of tomorrow by BBC Music Magazine, all the while staying true to herself. She's been redefining the traditional brass ensemble with her all-female Ten Ting, which is now touring the U.S. and have released their first CD on Warner Classics. I spoke with her this week by phone from her hotel in New York City. I am very happy to be speaking today with Tina Ting Helseth, a trumpeter. Sort of a strange question to start off here, because in reading about you and seeing how your career has developed, boy, it seems like you're doing everything you want to do. And
yeah.
I mean, has this whole thing sort of, you're still young, you got a lot to go yet, but has this kind of blossomed out along the lines of what you thought your career would be, if you're thinking back 5, 10 years ago?
I mean, I consider myself very lucky that I'm actually allowed to do almost exactly what I want to do. And of course, when I started when I was 18, so 12 years ago,
right,
with this crazy life of touring and playing, then of course, I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I wasn't ready yet, I guess, for all the crazy projects I'm doing now.
Right.
It's something that comes along. I mean, I didn't grow up in a classical home. So when I was a child, I listened to all kinds of music and maybe more other types of music than classical. But even though my studies and everything are purely classical, and of course, when I started my career, that was in the classical way, mostly playing with orchestras and all of that. Then I've always played other types of music. I've always had a lot of other projects that I wanted to do or something like that. So, you know, lately I've just kind of turned them all into reality. And probably something new is going to happen in a couple of years. And then a couple of years later, something else. And yeah.
Okay, cool. You're sort of riding the waves, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's been now, we're 2017, so it's even been 6 years. And I know monikers are weird, but, you know, you get that superstar of tomorrow label,
yeah,
which had to be cool in one sense, but also had to be, wait a second, hold on here. You know, I don't know if it was beneficial to you to have that kind of praise.
Well, first of all, it's really cool that someone recognized what you do and all of that. And it's really, of course, a privilege to have my job to work around as a soloist,
sure,
and play with, you know, the best orchestras and all of that. And so that's really cool. So I think it was just, for me, it felt like a boost.
Though these programs won't air close to one another, because you're airing this week and we're talking this week, and the other one will air in weeks to come. But yesterday I did an interview with something that's a bit of a rarity,
yes,
which is a woman concert organist of very high stature, high level here in the U.S. There just aren't really that many of them. You're even more of a rarity. Now, I've had Alison Balsam. She was a guest a couple years ago. But to have a female solo trumpeter is not normal. Now, you said how you didn't grow up in a musical home. However, you had an example right in front of you, right, with your mother. I mean, that's also pretty rare.
Yeah, I mean, I know that in a lot of countries, it is very rare. Actually, in Norway, it's completely common and normal. It's a lot of girls growing up playing brass instruments, everything from trumpets to tuba. So for me, it wasn't strange at all. All my friends played. A lot of them played brass instruments, some woodwind, of course. A very, very strong wind band and brass band tradition in Norway from school band age. And so for me, it wasn't really anything strange about being a girl and playing the trumpet until I started traveling abroad. Then I kind of understood that, okay, this is not so normal in all countries. And I mean, it's kind of rare to be a trumpet soloist anyway.
It is.
We're not that many. We're like four or five in the world who do this full time. So
yeah,
it's actually rare anyway, if I was a girl or not. And to be fair, I mean, it's two of us are girls. So it's kind of a good good percentage of women. I think, yeah, for me, it was completely normal.
Your mom played, right?
She did, yes, as a hobby, so not
right,
professional. I'm the
yeah,
first professional musician in the family, but yeah, she played trumpet.
Yeah, and that little postscript you said, that's what makes it rare. I mean, there are so few these days, there were more 25, 30 years ago, so few concert trumpeters are making a career as a solo artist. I mean, yes, they're sitting in orchestras, and the number of female brass players in orchestras has been growing steadily, but just that career. Where on your timeline, where did you make that decision that you knew you could try and then successfully have a career as a soloist?
Well, I might have been extremely naive as a child, but I can't remember thinking I would do anything else. To be
really?
Fair.
Really?
In one way, I guess, I had no idea what being a soloist meant. We had another great soloist earlier, Ole Edvard Antonsen, this Norwegian trumpeter,
mm-hmm,
that
yeah,
was traveling, and he was extremely famous back home at a certain time, and my parents knew him, so I kind of got to meet him very early on. And I do remember I wanted to do what he did. Of course, I didn't know exactly what that meant at the age of 10. 9 or whatever, but I already did a lot of solo stuff. But at that point, in one way, I didn't know that I was so good than I actually was.
Right.
I had a very nice teacher who never told me how good I actually was, which was a very good thing, because then I discovered at the age of 12 in my first competition, when I suddenly won over people that was way older, then I kind of knew it for myself more than trying to please someone else, because they're telling you that you're good, or, you know, getting that praise in that way, which I'm very grateful for, actually, that I discovered it myself. But I had the feeling that I was good because I got all the solos in the wind band and people, you know, told me nice things and stuff like that. But I don't know if, of course, at the age of 10, knew that I was going to be a soloist, but I just knew that I'm going to play the trumpet and this is what I'm going to do. To be fair, I never actually decided. Just sort of happened.
From her Warner Classics recording called Storyteller, here is my guest, Tina Ting-Helseth, performing transcriptions of music by the most famous composer from her homeland, two songs from Edvard Grieg's song cycle Haugtussa, or The Mountain Maiden. We'll hear Love, Haugtussa declares her love for a boy, and Among the Bilberries, Haugtussa is watching over her flock and sees a field of blueberries. Being an old trumpet player myself, I know with brass players, and it's the same with every instrument, but with brass players and trumpet players especially, you've got to develop, and I know you do this with your teachers, and you probably, that's what they heard in you, you have to develop a sound, a tone. There are usually trumpeters, not necessarily classical players, but trumpeters across the spectrum that you sort of hear and say, wow, or you sort of look at or listen to a lot. Where does that line? I know you got to meet Antonsen, but I mean, where are the past trumpeters that sort of inspired you or that you really heard, tingled your ears, you know, when you heard them play?
Well, I've always listened to a lot of different music, but right. not necessarily trumpet players, actually. Of course, at home we had CDs or LPs with with vinyl back in the days that my mom had of Maurice André and, of course, people like that. And then Chet Baker or Miles Davis, those kind of things. But to be honest, I didn't really listen that much to trumpet. I think the thing that I've heard since I was a child, a little girl, I think my sound was kind of there from the beginning, or not the sound I have now, of course, it develops all the time, but my voice was already then there somehow. So in that sense, it feels very much like me. My tone, my voice, my sound. Yeah, it feels like it's me, and it develops as I develop as a human being. Yeah, but I've always heard from when I was a little girl that I had my sound, my special sound.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, then, to take it another step of something that's a rarity, maybe not in Norway, but in the rest of the globe, it's you then gathered around friends of yours, and the way you say it, it was kind of just happenstance. It just sort of came together. However, I think if people say, okay, name an entirely female brass ensemble, they would stop at your tenting, and they would really have trouble putting up another finger because they wouldn't be able to. So, I mean, how did the group come about? These were all just friends, and it was just kind of, let's do this? Or did you know that when you were going to be putting this together and then putting out the new recording, as you have on Warner, this is kind of breaking ground a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the four of the trumpet girls in the ensemble, we studied together.
Yeah.
And when we were at school, we wanted to start an ensemble one day. We listened to the string ensemble in school, and we just thought, oh my God, we want to play that music, that kind of music. And we thought, you know, we can start an ensemble. Well, we did know that there was a lot of great female brass players, and there were, like, tons of them back home. And we were thinking, well, we're only girls, so why not do only girls? Because it was fun. It's like a gimmick somehow.
Yeah.
So we just invited some of our friends that we knew played well, and then we met up that summer and had some rehearsals and did a concert, and that was on my 20th birthday, actually, our first concert. And I've been the leader from the start, and then here we are 10 years later. I mean, it's not full-time at all. It's like a couple of tours a year. So this is the first time in the States, which is very exciting. So 3 weeks a year, and then we have a almost 3-week tour in the summer, different places in Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Italy. And then we meet again next year a couple of times. It's kind of how we do it, which is nice because then it's like a holiday, even though it's full on. It's like a holiday with 10 good friends. We have baby number 13 on the way.
Wow.
Right now. One of the trombones player are definitely pregnant. People can see that in the concert. In the ensemble, baby number 13. So for some of them, it's nice to just have a holiday away from a bit of me time, away from the kids and the husbands and all of that. Yeah.
Well, where is Tenting? It is a U.S. tour. So what does this entail? Where are you going?
Well, first, we started in South Dakota.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, at the university there. And then we went to Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And then we went on to the West Coast, so around San Francisco area. Then we are Chicago on some radio concert thing. Then we went over to the East Coast. Where have we been? Virginia, also in, Pennsylvania, Maryland, so, and now New York, and we're going to Philly, and then back to the middle. It's a bit all over, so I'm a bit confused with all the places.
That's okay.
But it's just, it's full on, yeah.
From the new recording on the Warner Classics label featuring my guests' unique brass ensemble, all-female brass ensemble called Tenting, here they are playing well-known music of Mozart from his piano sonata Kerschel 331, the Rondo alla Turca. Thank you. Of course, with the ensemble, you can do newer works. You're wide open for transcriptions and arrangements, which can be very fun. And there's some great things for brass ensemble. For you, for solo trumpet, I mean, after you've run your gamut of Haydns and Hummels and everything else that can fall into the solo trumpet range, the repertoire still, to this day, is not huge by any stretch compared to other instruments. How have you, over the years, and how do you plan to keep growing the repertoire for the trumpet?
Well, I've done some commissioning,
right,
and I still am doing that, trying to expand the repertoire in that way. We're getting living composers to write for the instrument. I think it's important in every sense to have living composer writing a lot of music, because you never know when a masterpiece comes along that's going to last for centuries, like some of the works we know now from Mozart and Beethoven and Mahler and, you know, all of that. And then for the trumpet, it's really cool to think that my playing, or how a composer see me as a musician, my playing, my sound, can, in a way, kind of develop the trumpet repertoire in one direction somehow. That we're several soloists right now, or trumpeters, that are commissioning music, and we're all very different. So that means that the repertoire kind of goes in a little bit of different directions. And if I can put a little bit of a mark on some of that, it's extraordinary to think about that. When I have this role, I think I have to do this.
Yeah.
It's kind of my responsibility somehow to be a part of developing the repertoire for the trumpet. Me personally, I do a lot of arrangement transcriptions myself. Well, basically, if I do vocal repertoire that I've done a lot, I just play whatever it says in the score without using words, of course, because I can't do that at the same time as playing. But, and a lot of other things, I arrange them into fit my instrument to be the trumpet. And I just think good music is good music. I also want to play, you know, Brahms, and even though he didn't write anything for trumpet, I also want to play his music. So I like to think of myself as a musician, first and foremost, and then my voice, my tool, happened to be the trumpet.
Yeah, I like your sort of voracious appetite for hearing music, whether solo or group, and saying, I want to play that. So,
yeah,
and you can do that. As a brass player, you can.
Then
yeah.
I just kind of borrow it and I play it.
But to go back to what you said earlier, there are so few trumpeters at your level, especially of a younger age, out there making an impact, making a living, as it were, that it does sort of fall on your shoulders if the repertoire for this instrument is going to increase, that you have to be part of that, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah,
it is
right.
My responsibility somehow when I have this position. And it's fun. It's really cool to ask composers to write and, first of all, get completely new, fresh music that no one has heard before. And then I think it's really interesting and fascinating to see how a composer see me. I think that's really cool, actually, because when they write for me, most of them will then write a bit different than if they write for Alison Bolton or Håkan Hardenberger, or, right, you know, it will be different. I just find that extremely interesting.
With a great composer, it's not really an issue, but it's funny sometimes how composers, when they write for brass, especially like something like a trumpet, they forget that you have to breathe. So sometimes they'll give you these pieces and it's just an endless stream of notes or whatever. And it's like, well, I do have to take a breath. You know, they're so used to writing for string instruments or such.
I mean, it's important to work with composers,
right,
that, you know, understand the instrument. But at the same time, I mean, it's also important to kind of try new things, and you shouldn't be scared of getting some strange, difficult stuff and see what happens with that and see if we can do something, make something new. But at the same time, it is important to take into account what's actually possible on the instrument.
Here's my guest, Tina Ting-Helset, all by herself in the three-movement divertimento by 20th Century and fellow Norwegian composer Jostein Sommerfeld. Thank you. You've been very concerned. You've actually done something about it. You've formed a group. You're concerned about the concert experience as well, saying, you know, how when people go to other things in the arts, but even more in a popular one, let's say a film or even a play or something like that, there's a different reaction than when they can come out of a classical concert. You talk with the audience quite a bit, don't you, at times?
I do.
Yeah. But also you formed, what is this group?
I was part of this group when I studied. That was all about trying to find new ways of how to perform classical music,
right,
in a way. And yeah, we were going for many years, and it's still something that I'm thinking about. I do think that we should honor the tradition of how we listen to, not listen to it, but how the kind of concert format is, you know, with the symphony orchestra there and people come in and the orchestra entails whatever. I think that's also sometimes important to do what's the tradition, but at the same time, it's important to do other stuff as well. So that can be different venues, unexpected venues. That can be them wearing that fancy tails. It can be just like talking to the audience. I do that a lot, and it's not really rocket science. It's just that I really feel that the minute I talk, and I do this like everything from a recital in Wigmore Hall or wherever prestigious place, I don't care about that. I want to be close to the audience. I want to be on the same level, because I mean, as musicians, we're not superhumans or something that's on a higher level than the audience. Yes, we have maybe an extraordinary ability of mastering our instrument and have a need to express ourselves through music. But I mean, on the other side, I'm just as vulnerable and like a normal, whatever that is, human being with all my flaws and everything else. So I don't want to be on a, on a higher level, up on a pedestal. That's not the way I want to be as a musician. So the second I open my mouth and start to talk and really show that voice, I feel like that wall between me and the audience is not there anymore. It's so nice. And then I also get a different response from them when I play. I feel more of a different type of connection that I really enjoy. And, you know, with tenting, now when we travel around, we do choreography, we walk around in the audience a bit. It's all about showing the joy of music making, why we do this. And I think that's important, no matter how serious the piece is and stuff like that. I still think it should come across why we do this, why we play, and how much that means to us, and how much that engages us, and what we want to tell the audience.
You also, if I remember reading, want the audience to have a reaction that to them is genuine. For instance, you said, you know, you'll come out of a movie with friends and they'll say, oh, that was an awful movie, or I can't believe they did this. But they'll come out of a classical concert and probably from an insecurity that they're not really sure what to say. They're not musicians.
Yeah, they think they need to know. They
right.
think they need to have a master's degree in musicology or in music to actually say something about the music. And that is, to me, so wrong, because it's important to just be able to, well, I like that. And it could be whatever in the concert. Oh my God, see how those violins were doing that. I love that place where it was rhythmical and then, you know, like this, or so beautiful when that happened. And then also be able to say, I think that piece was very boring.
Right.
I didn't understand that because it's so loud. I also think some music is, you know, boring, even though I have studied music. It's really important for me that everyone is allowed to have their own feelings and, as you say, just be genuine to themselves and trust their emotions, because no one can tell you how to feel about something. It's your experience. There's no rule for how to feel. There's not only one answer to it. It's not like math, you know, where mostly it's only one answer. And it's not like that with music and art, because it's feelings and they're yours.
And just the postscript to that, I mean, you're right around 30, that whole demographic of, let's say, late 20s, 30, up to 40, let's say under 40. I mean, do you see at your concerts, let's say outside of Norway, because, you know, you're very popular in Norway, but do you see that audience growing? I mean, I think it's also very important in Norway. It'd be great if that would happen to other places. You're also out there more than just the concert stage. You're on this medium, which is radio. You've been on television. So, I mean, there's a presence. They get to know you as a person, a personality, rather than just a musician. Is that one way to try to grow the audience at concerts and recitals of that age group?
I think it's just important that I try to be very true to myself. Like, I like Instagram and Facebook. I like those things. I like to post a photo from backstage or a fun something to show how this life is. I like to share what I'm doing. And I like to host the radio shows or host TV things or, you know, stuff like that. It's nice to be able to kind of show more of the music that I love without actually playing. It's nice to engage in different ways. And I do see in my concerts, and also here in the States, there's a lot of young people, which I think is great.
Right.
And they come to listen and they follow me on, you know, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. Yeah, I do see all over and in Europe, where I travel a lot. And since I was 18, it is actually quite a big percentage of young audience, which is, of course, really cool. But with that being said, a lot of people talk about there's a lot of gray hair in the concert hall with classical music. And I just think in one way, it's not strange, because when you have kids and you have you're working, you maybe you don't have tons of money and you don't have time. You don't want to have a babysitter coming around so that you can go on a concert Thursday night because you're knackered. You just want to sit in front of the TV or eat a good meal. You don't want to go out of the house maybe, and you don't have the time because you're driving your kids to soccer practice and football practice and dancing lessons. I don't know what, you know, it's full on life being a parent in that age. Then maybe it's very normal that when the kids are at a certain age, they move away, stuff like that. Then they have time to go to concerts, to go to art exhibitions, you know, all of that right. things. So maybe it's more normal than we think. Maybe it's that they still have the interest for classical music. It's just that they don't have the time to go. I think that to a certain extent.
That goes back to rethinking the whole concert experience. I know a couple months ago, and I think it was in the New York Times, what it appeared in the New York Times, the British pianist Stephen Hough had talked about, especially with recitals. I mean, the orchestra thing's going to be a little bit harder because you've got unions and all the rest of that. But, yeah. You know, to have a 90-minute concert with no intermission, and it just goes, like if you'd go to a film or something, you go and you sit and you and then you go and just do it that way. And it sort of restructure the thinking so that people whose time is precious for whatever reason, you know, can still...
Yeah, I've done that a lot. Like just without intermission, just a 90 minutes, 75, 90 minutes. And then they would get a lot of great music just without the intermission.
The first movement of Paul Hindemith's trumpet sonata is performed by my guest, Tina Ting-Helset, accompanied by the British pianist, Catherine Stott.
Thank you.
because you also do this, again, it's in your home country, but I'm only mentioning this because you're sort of working cross-culture with another art, in this case, the visual arts, but you're connected with even Americans, especially young Americans, especially really young Americans who don't know much about art, know the Scream.
Yeah.
One of the most popular paintings in the world and among American kids, one of the most popular paintings.
Yeah.
And you're connected with the artist who painted that and his museum. And tell us what you're doing. So
yeah, with Edvard Munch,
yeah.
the artist behind the Scream,
yeah.
and a lot of other great paintings.
A lot of other great paintings, however, yeah.
Yeah. I have a festival at the museum. We've been doing it twice. Now they're actually making a new museum, so we have to wait until the new museum comes.
Yeah.
So now everything is a bit, yeah, since they're moving and stuff like that. But I've had it for 2 years. It's very interesting. It's called Tina at Munch.
Okay.
It's been really cool to work on the whole aspect of programming and then being there among his art. And at the same time, trying to just put together a cool, interesting program, not thinking too much about the art, but also thinking about it. Because I want the concert in itself just to be a nice experience as a concert, but then maybe the paintings around can add to what's being played, but it can also just add for some of the people in the audience and not all of them. So it's a fine line between just really thinking when you program and I write some text. I also talk there, introduce and stuff like that, that it's maybe too much thinking about Munch. That is like too close of a connection somehow, that
yeah.
I don't know, sometimes that's nice, but sometimes it's also nice that the music is just there and that it kind of works no matter where you are. But it's been really, of course, really interesting, first of all, to get to know his life, reading a lot about him, visiting where he used to live, where he used to paint and stuff like that, and then just being around all those paintings.
Yeah.
There's so much emotions, and I don't know, it's really inspiring.
Great. You said things will happen in the next years, and you're looking forward to things happening, different things happening. A trumpeter, a concert trumpeter, unlike a pianist, unlike a violinist, can sort of get through the main repertoire in a few years just because of there's not. So, I mean, what do you look forward to? Are there things you still want to perform or things you want to try to work towards in the next years as you're, you know, in the
well,
next?
Definitely. There's a lot of things, but it's not all, it's a kind of classical orchestral solo repertoire. Right now I'm in the studio back home writing my own music.
Cool.
That I'm going to release on my 30th birthday, the 18th of August this year. And it's very different than people have heard from me before. It's more pop jazzy, and I sing mostly. I write all the lyrics. I have some great musicians with me. The jazz trumpeter, very famous jazz trumpeter in Norway, he's producing it. Yeah, it's something really different. But I've always been doing that since I was a kid, actually, writing music when I was in school. We made our own musical, and I wrote all the music. And so I have been doing this on the side, always. I've always been singing. And I'm doing it a little bit with my band, with my quintet. I like to call them my rock band. I sing there when we do concerts. A lot of jazz, mostly. So something completely different. And, of course, I'm extremely excited and completely terrified about really showing that side of myself, putting myself out there in that way. So it's a lot of exciting things coming up around that aspect of my career. And then, of course, continue developing the repertoire for the trumpet with commissioning. I'm doing a very interesting commissioning with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
That I'm doing this autumn with Elliot Goldenthal, writing a new concerto, which is very cool. And then, yeah, it's kind of going on and trying to find new, cool, fun, inspiring musical collaborations.
Well, it's great with Dirk Brosset and the Chamber Orchestra.
They're
a great group. When you get in here in the fall, make sure you contact us and we'll have you on live and you can talk about the concerto, maybe with the composer. That'll be great.
Yeah, and I have a lot of great things coming in the U.S. I'm very excited. The Cincinnati and then a tour with the Orpheus Chamber. It's a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if anybody's been listening here, you have not over your career shied away from doing things. You go full into it, which is great. And we'll look forward to anything. It comes out. It's exciting that you are impassioned as you are. And I said, being an old trumpet player, it's really cool that you're a trumpet player doing this, you know.
Well, that is cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
You.
I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. The first is a hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to, but could speak with them, pick their brain, what's the first name that pops into your head when I ask that question? Who would you love to talk to that you never had a chance to?
Beethoven.
Hmm.
I have no idea why, but that was what came to my mind. Yeah.
Wrangling a trumpet concerto out of him. Well, you never know, but...
I would love to have a trumpet concerto by Beethoven. I think Brahms is also one of my favorites that I wish would a trumpet concerto. I just think Beethoven has something so crazy about him, something so deep, a bit like in pain somehow. I mean, also the great sides of him, but I mean, the story says that he was quite rude.
Right.
and that kind of person, but I just think that would be really interesting to kind of talk to him about how his brain works. I think it's in a very unusual way.
Yeah, there's stories of him berating, you know, string players, but never the brass. But of course, the brass weren't as advanced back then, but
yeah,
still, you know.
True.
So there must have been some great brass players in the Vienna group there.
Yeah.
The final question is a non-musical question, meaning everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy, especially with tenting right now. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but pull yourself away, what do you do? What's your respite area?
I'm at home with my boyfriend, just doing normal stuff, sitting on our wonderful terrace, looking at, we live just by the ocean.
Oh, very nice.
Relaxing, making good food, meeting up with friends, going to dinners, looking after my good friend's kids. You know, it's just, yeah, just trying to really be with the people I love.
That's good.
And be calm, because it is a very stressful life on tour, and I've been doing this for a long time. But now, lately, in a couple of years, I've really tried to work a bit less and be more at home, because it is really important to just think about other stuff.
Tina Tinghelset, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Tina Tinghelset. You can find out more about her and her ensemble, Tenting, at her website, Tina Tinghelset, which is Tina is T-I-N-E. Ting is like our thing, T-H-I-N-G. And Helset is H-E-L-S-E-T-H. Tenting's new recording is on the Warner Classics label. Check it out at warnerclassics.com. I'll leave you with two tracks from that CD, two tracks from their suite from Kurt Weill's music for the Three Penny Opera. We'll hear the famous Mac the Knife, and then the Ballad of Easy Life, performed by Tenting, led by their founder and my guest today, trumpeter Tina Tinghelset. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.
Thank you.